musical linguistic
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. And I want to welcome you to a sample of what I call listener-supported podcasting. And by that, I mean it's not only that some generous souls have donated some of their hard-earned cash to help keep these podcasts floating around in cyberspace, but today's program is all about a little trip, pun intended, that one of our fellow saloners took recently. A few months back, you might remember, I read an exchange of emails between Matt Palomary and James, who joins us each week from Colorado, where he's been a pre-med student. And what they were talking about was the various ways a person can prepare for an ayahuasca experience, because James was heading to the Amazon with some friends to have the experience for the first time. Well, I'm pleased to let you know that James has now returned from his ayahuasca adventure, safe, sound, and perhaps even a little transformed. And since there has been so much interest in this topic in the email I've been receiving, I thought that it might be interesting for all of us to hear some of his stories firsthand. And James was gracious enough to agree. Now, one of the things I hope you'll take away from this conversation today is how James's seemingly mundane job that he needed to pay for books and tuition led to an ayahuasca adventure in the Amazon. And the point being that you never know when Lady Ayahuasca may be reaching out to you, so pay attention to the little things in life, even casual conversations, because you never know where they might lead. And now, please join James and me as we talk about his first experience with the vine.
I guess the best place to start is at the beginning. I was quite frankly really pleasantly surprised when I got your email and you talked about this, I guess, excursion, or class. I don't know exactly what to call it. Why don't you just kind of rewind for me and tell me how this all came about?
Sure. It's actually really strange. I've been into psychiatry. I'm about to take the MCAT. I'm going to med school. And to get through school, I was doing some carpet work. I was cleaning carpet to get through school. And I cleaned the carpet of a doctor that lives here in Colorado. And we started talking about things, and it kind of came up that he was interested in shamanism. And so the ayahuasca came up, and this is about 3 years ago. And come to find out, he had been working with some shamans from Ecuador. And those shamans came up and actually visited here in Colorado. So I was able to meet some of the shamans, and after spending more time with this doctor, he was planning a trip. This is 3 years ago, so he said he was planning a trip in a couple years.
So this professor, or this doctor, he organized this trip, and about how many people were there altogether that joined you?
There were 20 of us.
Wow, good-sized group.
It was. I think they were looking for about 20 people to go just to make the trip affordable. And then in addition to us, the 20 members that went for the trip, we had two guides that met us there that did everything with us.
Now, in the emails we exchanged before you guys went down there, I know that for sure you had never had any experience with ayahuasca. Had any of the other people experienced that medicine before?
Yeah, there were the two guides for sure. And then as far as people on the trip, there were some people that had gone trips in years prior, and I believe that they had multiple experiences with ayahuasca. But as far as the whole group, very few of us. I think there were only two people that had prior experience.
So I imagine there was some trepidation among all of you, not just the going to the jungle part, but the ayahuasca as well.
Absolutely. There were some people that had absolutely no psychedelic experience at all. I believe there are people that had never done any sort of psychotropic drug, really, other than, you know, say caffeine or nicotine or something like that. Mm-hmm. So this is definitely branching out for a lot of the people in our group. Some of us have had, I'd say, moderate psychedelic experience, but nothing like ayahuasca.
Was the group mixed age-wise, men and women, or how was that makeup that way?
I would say we were mixed pretty evenly as far as gender is concerned. Age, there were maybe six or seven of us under the age of 30, between 20 and 30, and then the rest were middle age.
Mm-hmm.
I would say 40 to, we actually had an elderly lady, a wonderful lady that came with us. I think she was late 60s, 70s.
Of course, now that I'm 65, elderly doesn't sound, it sounds a lot farther out, but I'll let that slide. You know, I don't feel that way on the inside, so it doesn't bother me at all.
It's all about how you feel.
It's all about how you feel. So do you have any idea how the organizers of this trip, how he made contact with the shamans? How did he find reputable ayahuasca shamans? Because that's a question that we're getting a lot. And, you know, I have some people I've been working with, but nobody really likes to pass out names, et cetera, because they don't want people to be swamped. But so I'm kind of curious if you know how he made contact with this particular group.
And actually, I actually asked our guide and several other members, as well as the shaman, if it would be all right if I mentioned their name. They were definitely against it.
I figured that, yeah.
Knowing that I was going to do this interview. I consider myself totally fortunate to just have run into the people that I ran into, and via their network of connections, had the opportunity to see world-renowned shamans. A lot of the shamans down there are definitely in it for the money. There's a lot of fakers. And so I know that's a big deal. As far as finding them down there, I have no idea. The particular shaman that we worked with ayahuasca, had been very good friends with our guide for 20 years, 30 years. And our guide was very good friends with some of the members of our group for 20, 30 years. So I have no idea how they actually ended up meeting. I was just fortunate enough to run into the right people at the right time. And I think you had said before that, you know, when it's time for you to do ayahuasca, or ayahuasca is calling you, it'll find a way to find you. And I think that's kind of how it happened for me and my friends.
I was just thinking that as you were talking. Yeah, because my story is similar to yours, but yours is truly amazing. Here you are working your way through school and cleaning carpets, and ayahuasca found you that way. It sounds like you couldn't have avoided this.
No, I was always interested in it. I always wanted to do it, and just the way that the synchronicities involved in us meeting the right people and going down there at this particular time, meeting this particular shaman, just absolutely amazing. And that really rang with me, rang true with me when you had said that in an earlier podcast, that, you know, when it's your time, I think it'll come to you. I don't think you should really worry a whole lot about seeking it out.
Well, that's the way it worked for me. I'm glad to see that it worked for at least one other person that way, and a couple others I've talked to. So we're going to leave it at that as far as finding the right contacts. Although one of the key things that you did say, and it was true in my case, is I made friends with some guides who had been working with the same people for, you know, 15, 20 years, and I'd known these people for quite a long time. So it's not like something that happens overnight. You don't get on a plane and fly to Peru and say, or Ecuador or wherever, and say, I'm going to, you know, seek one out. I think the patience comes in handy here, too.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's really important. There was such a connection between some of the members of our group and the shaman and our guide, that really, even though we were in a place we had never been, in the middle of the jungle, far from anything that's familiar to us, it felt like we had a safety net. We were safe with them. We knew that there was a connection between them, which helped us to feel safe and connected. So I do think there's something important about that.
Yeah, that's a really good point as far as the making the safe vessel to contain your experiences in. Why don't you just kind of... take us through your trip. I know that a lot of us can put ourselves in your position of saying, okay, well, I've never been to the jungle in Ecuador, and I don't know what I'm going to be looking at. And then on top of that, you have this ayahuasca experience ahead of you. So kind of, if you would, just take us through, you know, how you got from Colorado to the middle of the jungle.
Okay. Well, I think it'd probably be best if we just started from when we got there.
Okay.
We spent a week in the Andes, and this trip wasn't strictly about ayahuasca. We actually saw several other shamans that didn't really use many psychotropic plants at all. They were just spiritual healers, and they had, and we did many ceremonies with them prior to our ayahuasca trip, and this is in the Andes. Some of them did use other plants. We had the opportunity to chew coca leaves,
mm-hmm.
which that was pretty cool. So from after staying in the Andes for a week, it was time to go to the jungle. We were all psyched about it.
Did you in the Andes, did you get to any of the ancient sites while you were there?
In Ecuador, we no.
Okay.
We really were just there to see these particular shamans.
Okay, so this was really an investigation into the what we would call alternative medicine or shamanism. So you were really down there, not as tourists, but as sort of curious investigators.
Yeah, and not only in the sense of just trying to figure out what this is all about, but I think a lot of us went there to really be healed. We wanted to find out how the healing works so that we could pass on the knowledge to others, but on a more personal note, just to heal ourselves, to really experience what these shamans had to offer in terms of bettering ourselves as people. So it wasn't just to, you know, look and see, but also to, you know, to cure us of some possible ills that we thought they might be able to help with.
Right, right. And did you find that kind of like being there for a week and getting acclimatized to the environment and the culture just a little bit kind of helped get you set for your ayahuasca experience as opposed to if you've just flown in and the next day had the experience?
Absolutely. I think everything is so different down there that it's trippy right when you get there because everything's so new, and especially in the jungle. When you get deep into the Amazon, all the plants, I mean, it's like nothing you've ever seen. It looks psychedelic when you're totally sober. So many colors, so many different plants and animals and things that you've never seen. So I think that, yeah, it was really important. We went into the jungle and spent 3 days just kind of hanging out and getting used to being in the jungle, getting used to living there. We lived just like the shaman and his family out there. We ate grubs and new foods, and we just kind of got acclimatized to everything. And I think that was really important. That's a good point.
So did they encourage you to change your diet once you were there so that you were starting to do somewhat of an ayahuasca-type diet?
Well, I was really curious about that. Me and my friend looked into that, and especially after hearing Matt Palomary talk about the super rigorous diet that he was on. I remember him talking about, you know, no sugar. I can't remember exactly what he was eating, but it was like simple carbohydrates, and that was it.
Yeah.
And we really didn't change our diet a whole lot. In fact, most of the group had no diet restrictions up until the day of the ceremony. And even then, we didn't fast the whole day. We fasted from an early lunch, mm-hmm. and then the rest of the day was fasting. Me and my group of friends that I brought, we had abstained from red meat, alcohol, and tried to eat generally as many raw foods as we could for about a month prior to our trip in preparation. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a requirement. That was something that we did on our own after just researching it a little bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that in particular the alcohol, and I'm not against alcohol in used right, but that seems to be something that I've learned to avoid in the month leading up to it. So I think that was probably a good move on your part.
Yeah, I think it did help. Other members of our group, you know, being in another country, and they, you know, they wanted to hit the bar scene a little bit. They had drank, and I don't know that it was super deleterious to their experience at all, but I do know that some of those people did have a little harsher experience. And I think there was something in what Palomary was saying about it's about respect to the plant. You're kind of sacrificing these things, in some senses, physiologically, so they don't have any weird chemical interactions. But on another level, it's a spiritual kind of a, this is what I'm giving forth. This is what I'm giving to the plant. I'm sacrificing this in respect. And I think that kind of played a large part, at least in my mind, for the things that I gave up prior to the trip.
Yeah, I found the same thing, and although it took me a lot longer to figure that out, because you know, being a Westerner, you don't really kind of get into this the plant spirits as easily. But once you start kind of grokking that a little bit, it does seem to make sense as far as on some planes for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. When I'm talking about this to a lot of my friends at school or other doctors, they're very wary. When I talk about it in non-physiological terms like that. Interestingly enough, I had seen another shaman. He was actually one of the heads of the Association of Shamans in Ecuador 3 months prior to our trip. And I asked him, you know, am I ready for ayahuasca? Am I prepared? And he looked at me, and the way shamans look at you, it's like they look right through you. It's the weirdest feeling.
You're right.
They're very deep. It's like looking into a bottomless cave. And he looked me up and down, and he said, no, you are definitely not ready. This is 3 months prior of the trip. And I said, well, what can I do to prepare? And he said that I should meditate, which I meditate every day anyway, but I really kicked it up a notch. And he also said that I should abstain from sex for 2 weeks prior to the ayahuasca ceremony. So I also did that on his recommendation. And it seemed to work out fine, because when I got there, we actually met up with this shaman, and he said I was well prepared and was very strong and ready to go.
Yeah, and as you just pointed out, I think it's a combination. I think there definitely are some physiological factors involved here, particularly with the food and alcohol, et cetera. But there's also this psychological component as well. And so I think you know, the more that you do to prepare. Whether it's following somebody else's regimen or just doing your own preparation, but you know, focusing on what's coming seems to be the way to maximize the experience.
Absolutely, definitely.
Now, I saw some pictures that you sent. It looked like you actually were watching them prepare the brew. Is that the fact?
Yeah, it was. I loved that part of the trip. That day, the day of the ayahuasca ceremony, in the afternoon, the shaman took us around his home, which I also sent you a picture of that big thatched hut kind of house. We walked around his garden, and he showed us where he grows the ayahuasca, and he told us a little bit about how they prepare it, and that he told us about five different kinds of ayahuasca vines that in the jungle, and how he only uses one particular kind. The kind of vine that we used was 25 years old. It takes generally, you know, two decades or more to become fully mature. And then he also showed us how they prepared it into small sections, shaving off the bark. And they would put a layer of ayahuasca and a layer of Psychotria viridis or some other DMT-containing plant, and then another layer of ayahuasca, another layer of DMT, another layer of ayahuasca, fill the, whatever they put it in, usually a large cauldron, fill that with water and boil it for several hours. And we got to see all this.
Wow. That's really, really interesting. I've never had the opportunity to actually see the brew prepared in person. You know, I've seen pictures of it. So that makes a nicer connection. Is that the brew you actually drank that night?
It was, yeah, it was very rude. I do think there was something comforting about seeing the actual plants that you were going to partake in later that evening.
Yeah, it is a continuation of building a relationship with the plant, I believe. So what that afternoon you were essentially fasting from you know, a late lunch on, and then what time did your ceremony start, and how did it unfold?
Okay. It was an early lunch that we had an early lunch, not a late lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we ate about 11, and then the rest of the day we fasted, and I believe the ceremony started probably around 9 o'clock or so. It was just that it had been dark for less than an hour probably. And we all got in that picture that I sent you of the large thatched hut. That's actually the place where the ceremony was held. And they laid down mats, and the bottom of the hut is all open air. There was a ceiling, a thatched ceiling, and then there were no walls.
Mm-hmm.
So around the edge of the inside of this hut, they laid down mats, and we all sat down in a circle or a semicircle. And the people, about half of our group, a little more than half of our group, ended up taking ayahuasca. The other half were going to be sitters or helpers. If some of us needed to go to the bathroom or something like that to help us walk and things like that, they sat on the other side completing the circle. Then the shaman was at the head of the circle with a table behind him, and on the table he had set little teacups full of ayahuasca prepared specifically for each person on our trip. I think he prepared them in terms of body weight and also what he thought that we needed. And one by one, he came to each person and gave them a cup of ayahuasca. Oh, and this is actually, he drank the ayahuasca before anyone else did. He drank a full cup himself.
Right. You know, this is very similar to the tradition that I participate in as well, where the shaman, particularly after he gets to know you even better, can adjust the dose level depending on what you're trying to do that night or where he thinks you are, and like you say, body weight, etc. So these guys have a lot of experience with this kind of thing. They can kind of size you up pretty quickly, it seems to me.
Absolutely, and I think this goes back to both the physiological thing and the spiritual mental thing. I think they consider both, just like the diet and preparation. When you're about to actually take it, I think a shaman takes those two components into consideration before giving you whatever amount.
Yeah, I agree.
After that, everyone was real nervous. It was just like electricity in the air. Everyone was, you know, half excited, half anxious, half just blown away by the whole experience so far. And after we all drank, me and my friend said a couple of personal prayers and meditated together. That day we had been meditating all day in preparation. And after we all drank, we sat up there in the dark, and they turn out all lights, so it's very, very dark. There's not a whole lot of light in the middle of the jungle anyway. And we all sat there for about 20 minutes or so waiting for the onset of the effects. And at first, I just remember being really, really nervous. It came to mind, Hunter S. Thompson, you know, buy the ticket, take the ride. Well, we had all bought the ticket, and just waiting for the ride was very anxiety provoking, because you just don't know what's going to happen. And I would say at about the 20, 25 minute mark, one of the members of our group, a good friend of mine, began purging already. It hit her very quickly. And that was when we were all like, okay, we're really starting to feel something. It began with somatic type feelings. Just my whole body was just filled with energy, very strong. In terms of like Shulgin scale, I think me and my closest friend, our trip was about, I would say, between a 2 and a 3. And a lot of other people had, I didn't have a whole lot of visuals during the trip. Some other people had, I mean, I did have a few. Some other people had amazing, very deep visuals. Mine was more, I tend to be a bit of a feeler anyway. So a lot of what I experienced were insights and insights into my life and into problems that I may have had. And whereas some other people definitely, like, were seeing all kinds of different things.
Well, I think
as far as purging is.
Yeah, go ahead and talk about that, and then I've got a number of questions I want to ask you. But let's go ahead and cover the purging thing.
Okay. Well, yeah, there's so much that happened and so many things that I'd like to say that I just like don't know where to go. So it might help If you ask me some more specific questions about different aspects of people's trips and experiences, I can kind of go from there. But as far as purging, our guide as well as the shaman, a lot of the people were, being Westerners, very new to the idea of purging. We all look at vomiting like it's this horrible, horrible thing, and diarrhea. But in terms of an ayahuasca ceremony, it's actually a very beneficial thing. It's something that people look forward to doing. And even though I'd heard stories about people, fasting for a day and having absolutely nothing in their stomach, but still vomiting out just this massive loads of a physical manifestation of all these, spiritual or psycho material that these negative feelings that you have or negative things that you're getting out of your system. And my friend, she must have had a lot of negative things. She puked for about 2 hours. And this was her first psychedelic, so you can imagine she was definitely in a frantic state there for a little while.
Well, that brings up something I think very interesting here, is that I have seen this a lot, and I've talked to other people who say the same thing, is that your first few psychedelic experiences are the ones particularly that are going to be the roughest, because that's where you're bringing up a lot of things. And if, of course, your first experience is on ayahuasca, where purging is normal, it could be a very good first psychedelic experience, as long as you're prepared to face the stuff that's coming up. But I think that your friend probably might have had as rough a ride with any psychedelic, because that's often the case.
Absolutely, and in retrospect, even the next day, she was very happy, felt so much lighter. She knew it was something that she needed to do. And in fact, she even said, I can relate her experience later. It was just an amazing thing that happened to her. She felt like she had more to get out after the end. She said she felt like she wanted to do ayahuasca again, because it wasn't all out. And even though the experience of it was very, very hard, she said it was absolutely one of the most beneficial things ever. The next day, she was just happy and floating and so happy that she had done it, although she did say it was one of the scariest things that had ever happened. And I think that's how most bad trips are. They're not bad in themselves. I mean, the experiences can seem negative at the time, but the overall net effect is always good, I think, if you open yourself up to those. And I think that's what she did. And our guide and the shaman all said that she did very, very well. That was what she needed to do.
Yeah, it sounds like you had some really good guides and shamans for a young woman to have her first experience, first psychedelic experience, then come out on the bright side. Sounds like she was really in good hands.
Absolutely. We all were. And that, I think that had a major benefit to all of us there. Being in a strange place, doing a strange plant medicine, and just having strange experiences, leave you in a precarious mental state. It doesn't feel like you have a whole lot to fall back on sometimes. And having someone like the shaman we had, it was just his presence alone just made you feel safe. He was absolutely the most humble person I've ever met, most powerful in his humility that I've ever met. And being around him, you felt safe. We'd also heard many stories of him being able to actually stop someone's experience while on ayahuasca. I guess prior groups that our guide had taken to this same shaman, an elderly lady had actually passed out and become unconscious during ayahuasca ceremony. It was just too intense for her. And the shaman came out and sucked the experience out of her stomach, and she immediately woke up and was immediately sober and didn't experience anything else for the duration of the ceremony or in the days following.
I've heard other stories like that really ring true. It's just amazing when somebody can do something like that, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's mind-boggling. We don't understand how they do it, it's just absolutely amazing. And being around somebody like that really, I think, lets you let go a little bit more than you would if you didn't have something like that. So you can really dig into your experience a little bit and not have to worry about, am I going to come back or am I damaging myself? There's somebody looking out for you that's been there a million times and is confident in his ability to navigate these other worlds that you're experiencing.
Something you said just a moment ago about how you felt safe with the shaman, that may be one of the keys for people when they are going down to the Amazon and seeking out a shaman if they don't have any pre-connection. But if they go down there, if they feel good about the guy, if they're not feeling edgy, I think that's number one, because I've heard stories of some of these guys are real charlatans. And if you don't feel safe with a guy, you really shouldn't be doing a psychedelic journey with him, you know?
Absolutely. And that was the same with all the shamans we saw were world-renowned healers. They're very famous for what they do, and every single one of them has the same presence about them. I think it's really important. You should really, when you're going through a healing, you should really feel something, feel drawn to that person before you do a healing with them. I think that's really important. Our shaman actually, he differentiated between, I should also say that all the shamans that we saw were Quechua shamans, as opposed to, I know a lot of people do ayahuasca with, in Peru with the shuar.
Right.
And so just to let people know what type of shaman and what type of indigenous people we were staying with is the Quechua. And in the Quechua tradition, they differentiate between their shamans and their yachaks. Yachaks are the highest level of attainment for a shaman. And actually the shamans, as our shaman explained to us, are actually people who know how to heal, who have these supernatural powers of being able to navigate these psychedelic worlds, but haven't conquered their own ego enough to be humble in knowing that they have this power. The Yachaks, on the other hand, as our shaman explained, are always going to be very humble, very there's not going to be any ego in them. And all the shamans that we met and worked with really had this feeling of there was absolutely no ego in anything they did. They really were doing it just for us. They were really, when they were looking at you and talking to you, it was just with you. There was this real feeling of caring and gentleness and humility in everything they did. And I think that might be something that's important to look for too.
Yeah, that's really a good thought, and it's interesting to hear the distinctions they're making in shamans, because that really is the danger in this whole thing, is that people can get inflated with themselves if they're not careful. Let me ask a couple quick questions, and then I'll let you kind of finish up on your end of the journey. But the questions I know that are going to come up with some other people. Not necessarily they won't know it's a question until it happens, but that from the time in the afternoon after your meal until about 9 o'clock at night, wasn't that one of the longest periods of your life, or is that just me?
No, it was, well, you know what? We filled it up with so many things. It wasn't like we were just sitting around, and I had heard from our guide that other groups of people that he's taken there when they're fasting, they've actually gone on long hikes during this period, which to me didn't seem very smart at all, because I'm used to eating, you know, like most Americans, every, you know, 3 or 4 hours. But I guess it's not really such a big deal there. When you're in the jungle and you're living like they do, and you know you're doing this in preparation of something huge, I don't know, it just didn't seem that bad for us. We spent a couple hours meditating, but the rest of the time was spent with the shaman in his garden, so to speak. We couldn't really tell where the garden ended and the jungle began, but he seemed to know, and had all these plants that he was growing, and showed us around that. So we were doing stuff, and even though we didn't, the people that weren't doing ayahuasca, they still had dinner, and we joined them for that, just to talk more about what we were going to do that evening. And so it was, it really didn't seem that bad.
Well, that's good. I know, because as you were talking, particularly then after you took your drink and you're sitting in the dark quietly waiting, I almost had the feeling coming back on me. I could feel myself starting to move into that space, because it is sort of a strange time. And then when the first person purges, in my case, I always feel, okay, that gives me the okay to do whatever I want to do now. I don't have to hold back. I can purge. You know, nobody wants to be the first, it seems, to do that.
Yeah, I think we kind of had the same feeling going on. I don't know if, you know, I wonder who's going to feel it first. I wonder who's going to purge first. I think we were all kind of thinking about that. And, well, my friend, she took care of that for us, for sure.
I know one time I was the first to purge, and I felt really proud of the fact that I'd made it okay for everybody else.
Well, it was funny. My friend, she was purging, like I said, for hours. Everybody else, I think a little over half of the group purged. Me and my friend actually never purged, which was weird. We thought we were going to. I thought for sure I would, and nothing. I think it was due to all the preparation we had done. Maybe, I really don't know why. But I think ayahuasca, you know, kind of gives you what you need, and if you don't need to purge, then you won't. I think a lot of people get hung up. I've heard of people saying that, you know, you have to purge or you're not getting any, you're not getting the full experience. Then conversely, I've heard other people say that you don't want to purge because you want to hold the medicine in as long as you want. And I think, it might be smart to play it a little more relaxed than that. I think what will, if you need to purge, ayahuasca will make you purge. If you don't need to, then you might not. And I don't think there's really any need to get hung up about the purging at all.
Yeah, I'm right with you there. And in fact, the first several times I did ayahuasca, I didn't purge either. But I was really careful about my preparation the first several times. And like you, and I think that the shaman was right. You were ready, and that's probably you had done so much preparation of the psychic material you already had. Unburdened yourself somehow, and it wasn't until I got kind of cocky after four or five times, and I didn't follow the diet and everything quite as faithfully, and all of a sudden I started purging, and now I found it doesn't really have much to do with anything other than what ayahuasca wants to teach me at the time, and I'm either going to or I'm not.
Absolutely.
I don't even worry about it.
Yeah, you just have to let go into the experience for sure, and whatever's going to happen, it's going to guide you.
And like you, I didn't have much in the way of visuals for a long time. It's only recently now that I get visuals. But I think that you hit the nail on the head where you said, well, it was a +2 to +3, not many visuals, but the insights are the main things. You want to talk about that some?
Yeah, absolutely. Right after it started to kick in and we were all just feeling surges of this electrical energy, The shamans down there, or all the people actually, refer to Mother Earth as Pachamama. And I was really, really nervous, and the shaman had told me, you know, just open up to Pachamama, open up to Pachamama. And I was feeling overly anxious, and I just asked for help. I said, I want to be okay through this, I want to learn something, you know. I really just opened myself up. And then I actually had an auditory hallucination, which is, I've never had an auditory hallucination on any other psychedelics. And Mother Earth actually whispered to me, said, just breathe, baby, just breathe. And from then on, from that point, this is about probably half hour, 45 minutes into it, from that point on to the rest, for the rest of the ceremony, I was as calm as I've ever been in my entire life. It was absolutely amazing. I felt embraced by the jungle, embraced by Mother Earth. Part of the insights had to do with I tend to be really overcritical of myself and others, and I just was filled with love for not only myself but for, and not in a selfish way, but just the realization that I'm trying, doing my best, and so are others, and that everything's really okay the way it is. I think we tend to try to force the world to be a certain way many times, and I think ayahuasca was just kind of telling me that for the most part, even though things seem so bad in so many different ways, there's good people trying, everyone's trying to do their best, and that everything in general is okay, and it's going to be okay, no matter what happens. That was the overall insight, as well as many, many, like, sub-epiphanies that I had throughout the night about little personal things that I had been either thinking about or working on myself. As far as visuals, this was another interesting thing about the trip that I should probably say, or the ceremony, is that night, while you're having the experience, each one of you, each one of the members of the group are brought up individually to the shaman, and the shaman performs a healing while you're sitting on this little stool, and he's sitting in front of you, where he's singing aikaros or spiritual songs, and that I had never heard of in any readings or research I had done on ayahuasca ceremonies. But the interesting part is the following day, you get a personal interview with the shaman, and he tells you what he saw in his vision regarding you and your life. So whereas even though I had very few visuals, the visuals that I did have, he'll explain them for you or interpret them for you or help you interpret them, as well as interpret his own visions regarding you. So you really do get a good idea of what the experience was all about, from not only from your own interpretation, but you know, a master shaman's interpretation, a Yuchek. So I thought that was very interesting.
That really is.
As far as my visuals, I thought that was amazing. I'd never heard of anything like that, and everybody really, really appreciated it, especially the people that were new to the psychedelic realms. You know, when you in an ayahuasca ceremony, when you see a snake or a snake's doing something to you, which is a common vision, generally it means something. And if without that interview, you might not know. In fact, there were some really interesting visuals that me and some others had that turned out to mean something pretty interesting. My friend, the one who was Captain Purge a lot for the whole experience, she saw a huge gorilla. A huge gorilla with, she said, laser beam eyes in this tree, this huge tree that was outside of the hut, and the laser eyes were pointing to her chest somewhere, and she said she was very, very frightened of this gorilla. Well, during the healing, the individual healing with the shaman that night, he had said that he saw rows of yellow flowers stemming from her left hand up around her shoulders and down to her right hand. And one of the flowers that was over her heart was dead. And this dead flower was due to a difficult relationship that had ended. And it really freaked her out, because she had just broken up with a boyfriend of hers, and she was devastated by this. And the shaman knew it and said that was representative of this dead flower.
Did the shaman know it in advance, or did he intuit it?
He knew it in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean advance of?
I mean, did she
tell all this out?
Did she tell him, or did he intuit it on ayahuasca himself?
Oh, he intuited it on ayahuasca himself. She said nothing regarding this to actually anybody on the trip.
Okay,
I don't think. And so, yeah, he just totally knew this, and this kind of blew her away. She was just amazed that he would know this. But what he said was that this gorilla, in the trees with these laser eyes, was not trying to harm her. The visions are often very scary. He said to look past the scariness and the fear, and that actually he was trying to point out with those laser eyes the flower that she needed to work on. During the healing, he said that he had given her a new yellow flower to place over the dead one that would grow strong with a new relationship that was going to come in her future. What's really strange about this is my other friend that was lying to the right of me, he said he had the strongest open-eye visual he had ever seen that was more concrete, more real than anything he'd ever seen, was that during Captain Perkzalot's healing with the shaman, he saw a yellow spirit go into the back of the shaman's head, as well as a yellow spirit between her and the shaman.
Wow.
And he could close his eyes for a minute or more and open it. It was still there. He said he'd never seen anything like that. And this is someone with quite a bit of psychedelic experience. He'd never seen a vision so concrete in this reality. He was just absolutely amazed. And he goes right along. He didn't find out till later, after my friend, Captain Perzalot, had told him about what the shaman had said regarding the yellow flower and everything, that he was like, oh my God, you know, I saw the yellow flower he was putting there. I saw the spirit that he was calling upon to do this, and it was yellow. And so it's experiences like that, which there were several of by several different people, that are just absolutely amazing, like nothing I've ever experienced before.
And that's exactly what I'm sure you meant by a life-changing experience, having things like that happen.
Absolutely. I think for a lot of people, the universe and reality got a whole lot bigger that night, where we tend to see things in such a narrow view. And I think an experience like this, especially someone who has never been open to ideas like this or experiences like this, it really opens them up.
Well, you know, I can tell just listening to you that the spirit of the vine, the spirit of the jungle, has returned home with you. And that's really, I think, part of what this work is bringing the living, breathing essence of Gaia back to some of these dead areas. And I think that perhaps the reason it's happening in the center of this country is like it's happening everywhere. It is what's bringing us all together, and it seems like these plants are trying to wake us humans up.
Absolutely. I think especially with hopefully I'll be out of med school in another 4 years, and there's a lot of research. I was really, really glad to hear Charlie Grobe on the show. He's done some amazing research, and I hope to continue in those footsteps. There's a lot of research. So we've got people who aren't into it in any scientific way that are experiencing it and bringing back the messages that the plant's giving. But on another level, we're trying to figure out exactly what the physical correlates of it are. And I think that on all these different levels, it's all good. We're trying to figure out what these plants are trying to tell us. And hopefully, I really do think there's a lot to change. But ayahuasca said it's all going to be okay. So I think it will be. And I think the plants have a big part to play in that.
As I was listening to this with you just now, I began to better understand what Sasha was saying in last week's podcast when he said he wasn't creating chemicals but was creating instead a vocabulary of awareness. I'm not sure if this is exactly what he means, but to me, what I now see is that after having some of these experiences, you do develop a sort of unspoken vocabulary of awareness. I know it sounds strange to think about a nonverbal vocabulary, but in a way, that's what sometimes takes place when psychonauts compare notes. For me, there were several points in our conversation where I could allow myself to be transported back to what was ayahuasca space for me, particularly the part where he was talking about it first starting to take hold. And if you've been there yourself, then you know exactly what I mean. And even though I'm not attempting to describe the feeling, at least that's how I understand Sasha's vocabulary of awareness. In fact, I saw it in action again this past weekend when some friends stopped by and we were discussing the differences between 5-MeO-DMT and toad venom. Which has 5-MeO as one of the active ingredients. But only one of our group had actually tried toad venom, and although all of us had done 5-MeO. And so in order to explain what was different about the toad venom, we wound up using a third substance that we'd all tried as a way to better illuminate the nuances of our conversation. And it was really as if that third substance acted as a higher-level vocabulary for us to use to talk about the experiences that are by definition ineffable, which makes me sometimes wonder why we even try to describe them in the first place. But I'm thankful to James for sharing his adventures with us, and as he told me later, he really has only just begun to process all that happened to him on this trip. And I have a hunch that we'll be hearing more from James in the years to come. Thanks again for those stories, James. I almost feel as if I was there with you. Oh, and by the way, I will be posting those pictures that James sent, so you'll be able to find them with the program notes for this podcast, which I'll post at www.psychedelicsalon.org sometime in the next day or so. And I guess while I'm being thankful, I also want to be sure to send my love and gratitude to Zachary M., Edward Z., Kevin M., and Doug M., all of whom sent donations to help offset the expenses of these podcasts. I really do appreciate your support. It means a lot to me. And while I'm thinking of it, there are some other fellow Saloners who I've thanked in previous podcasts, but haven't sent an email of thanks to you yet. And I want you to know that I haven't forgotten about you. and that also goes out to some of you who have written to ask questions that I haven't gotten a chance to answer yet as well. I want you all to know that my intentions are good, but my follow-through leaves a lot to be desired these days. You know, there was a time in my life when I could multitask and get all kinds of things done in a day. And to be honest, I thought my own parents were kind of wimping out when they got to be the age I'm at now. And I couldn't understand how they could accomplish so little in a day or a week. But now I finally get it. You know, actually, one of my grandchildren pointed it out the other day when she called me a slowpoke. And that was when I realized that, you know, I'm just not going to get everything done each day that I want to do. And the real reason, the real bottom line here is that, hey, it feels good to slow down a little, to stop and enjoy the view once in a while. I think it was John Lennon who said something to the effect that life is what happens while you're planning what to do next. So I've pulled back a little from the planning part and have been trying to enjoy the moment. And now I do read every email that comes in each day, and sometimes I even get off an answer once in a while. But if I don't turn off my computer each day before I get everything done that's waiting there for me, you know, if I don't just put it down and walk away, I'll never get another book read in my life. And I've got a shelf full of unread books that I've been looking forward to reading for far too long. So please don't think that I'm not thinking about you or thinking about an idea or two that you sent my way. It's just that until we reach the point that Teilhard talked about when he said the noosphere awakens, until we get there and have some kind of super psychic ability, I guess you're just going to have to take me on my word that I like your comments, suggestions, new ideas, and even your complaints, although I'm happy to report that there haven't been many of those. In fact, it's rare that I don't agree with the sentiments in your emails, and I do appreciate the thought that goes into them. For example, near the end of a recent email from James M., he said, "It's just a ride, and we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings and money. A choice, right now, between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love, instead, see all of us as one." Well, I think that's very well put, James, and thanks for that. Because it really is just that simple. And yet, as they say, the devil is in the detail. So what that business about we're all one really means is that we're also all one with those screwheads in the world capitals who have led us into this mess. And I know I must sound like a broken record, but I do believe that the path out of our collective insanity will at least be lighted by psychedelic medicines, you know, medicines that are mind-manifesting, soul-manifesting. They're not for everybody, and they're definitely not for the faint of heart. But as we heard today, those who are called and who are willing to venture into the unknown are often rewarded beyond their expectations. And hey, being here with you for these podcasts far exceeds any expectations that I had for my life just a few short years ago. What a psychedelic trip this has been for me, being here with you in the psychedelic salon. You know, as Terence McKenna often said, ultimately, we're all just creatures of language. And before I go, I want to mention that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 2.5 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click on the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at www.psychedelicsalon.org. And if you have any questions, comments, complaints, or suggestions about these podcasts, well, send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. And Jacques, Cordell, and Wells, my friends who make music under the name Chatul Hayuk, thanks again for the use of your great sounds here in the salon, you guys. Really appreciate it. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.